Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fireside Chat number 240.
Yes.
It's too bad you don't see Megan the Arms smile, because it's rare that I get the right number. 240. On rare occasion, well, let me just open up by saying I'm Dennis Prager, and this is my chance every week to talk to you from my heart and my mind about what is on my mind, and then half the time is what is on your mind with your questions. This is Otto, of course, America's best known dog, which cracks me up, I have to say. It has no impact on Otto, but it does crack me up. Very rarely, I would say, what is it, maybe six times a year, a maximum of six times a year, I actually have a guest on the Fireside Chat. And there's a reason for that. I really have tried to preserve these weekly times as really you and I. That has been very important to me. But there are people that I really have wanted to interact with at length on this. My guest is one of those people, Batya Unger Sargon. And if you didn't quite catch that last name, I'll say it again, Unger Sargon. It is from the Harry Potter series. Doesn't it sound like it? Now that I think of it. Batya is a very, very interesting individual, a thinker. I love thinkers. She is associate opinion editor? Is that your title?
Deputy opinion editor.
Deputy opinion editor at Newsweek. And by the way, I have no vested interest in saying this, but Newsweek over the last few years has truly improved, and I read it regularly. It's a free ad for Newsweek. I don't agree with every article, but that doesn't matter. There are still things worth, a lot of them worth reading. Now, you may be wondering why Batya is on the Fireside Chat, because there are a lot of associate editors out there. Was that right? Associate? No, deputy. Yeah. There are a lot of deputy editors out there, a lot of deputies. But this is a woman who has questioned herself and questioned American thinking. So I want to develop your intellectual autobiography to begin with. If I had have met you 10 years ago and said, what are you politically, what would you have said?
I would have said, I'm a liberal.
Would you have said that you are, if I have then said, or somebody else said to you, would you say you're a leftist? Would you have said, okay, yeah, that's fine?
Yeah.
Right. So leftist, liberal, either one, because more or less synonymous in your mind. What, if I ask you as of this moment, what would you say you are politically?
I would say I'm a Marxist.
I didn't expect that, ladies and gentlemen. I have to admit, I had a feeling this was going to go in directions I had no idea. This is the sort of Yogi Berra moment when there's a fork in the road, take it. That is what we call a fork in the road. You're a Marxist. You're kidding me.
No.
So are you to the left of the liberal I would have met 10 years ago?
On some issues, yes. And on some issues, no. So when people criticize critical race theory, for example, and say it's a Marxist ideology, I kind of want to laugh, because the problem with today's left is an insufficiency of Marxism. And by that, I mean, they don't care about class. And I really care about class. I think the number one threat to American democracy is the enormous class chasm that's opened up between the college educated and the working class. And I think that the entire working class has been deplatformed from American society. They have no voice in political life. And I think that's extremely dangerous. And because my analysis of our problems are class-based, I call myself a Marxist, because that was Marx's point of view. Now, I don't accept his solutions. And things like critical race theory, the use of the sort of Marxist binary between powerful and powerless that you now see in gender and in racial discussions, I totally reject that. I think that is so totally corrosive. You know, I'm religious. It's so against everything my religion tells me about what makes us human, what makes us Americans, what makes us, you know, worthy of God's love. But at the same time, I have to say, I think that my analysis of what ails us is quite Marxist in nature. There's a spiritual component to it, but there's also an economic component to it. And I think that that should be the focus of people who care about the American family, for example. I want to see them talking about economics. I'm going to ask you about that as well. But so I would say, yeah, in some ways, I'm further left on economics, but not in a way that that today's left would recognize. They believe in welfare. They believe in handouts. They want the working class to essentially belong to the poor. They want to sustain them and support them. They want rich people to sort of basically underwrite the existence of everybody who's not as rich as them. And I think that that's really insulting and gross.
I get you. I really do get you. Let me just say, forgive me one moment. So I really want to just address for a moment those watching. I studied Marxism. That was my field of study, and communism and the left. So I can explain in very briefly what is involved here. And you are certainly free to react. But I understand everything you just said. And here is what it is. Marx divided the world by class. Hitler divided the world by race. Communism and Nazism had everything in common except that. They both exterminated vast numbers, tens of millions of people. They were both vicious. They were both pure cruelty. They were both totalitarian. But they weren't the same philosophically. And what the Marxist slash communist view of the world is the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie or class difference. And Hitler, it was race difference. The left today, ironically, and you're certainly free, you know that, to differ with anything or modify anything I say, but the left is closer to Hitler's totalitarianism than to Stalin's, because they do divide the world, not by class, but by race.
Wow, that is so interesting. I personally feel that too many people are compared to the Nazis and to
Hitler. I'm not compared. No. So I'm only doing it philosophically. There were no death camps. There are no concentration camps. People aren't being tortured to death. I fully acknowledge that. I'm only talking philosophically.
The obsession with race on the left today is reminiscent of the worst people that ever walked planet Earth. I completely grant you that. But I think you too, by my definition, are Marxist. And the reason I think that is because when I listen to you talk about COVID and about the way that the government used this as an excuse for the greatest upward transfer of wealth in American history from the middle class to the disgustingly wealthy. When I hear you talk about the impact the lockdowns have had, how they benefited the laptop class and penalized and turned the working class who sustained that class with their labor into, you know, lepers, you know, forced them to bear the burden of the risk and then treated them like dirt for having done so, enforcing all of these mandates on them. That's a Marxist analysis of where we failed. That is a class-based analysis of the way in which the pandemic impacted different sectors of American society differently. And so I think you too are a Marxist.
No, I don't have any issue really. I mean, I have a lot of issues with Marxism in other aspects, as I know you do, because you just said you did. So in light of that, You might call Donald Trump a Marxist.
I say I'm the kind of socialist that Donald Trump was. I thought his economic policy was spot on. I thought it was great for Black Americans, for Hispanic Americans, the lowest unemployment in Black American history. I thought that getting rid of NAFTA was fantastic. I thought the trade war with China was fantastic. I love these tariffs. I think his economic policy was what Bernie Sanders would have implemented had he won either of the elections.
You think Bernie Sanders would have implemented?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bernie Sanders in 2015 was asked by Ezra Klein, you care about the poor so much. Shouldn't we have open borders? Shouldn't we care about the global poor? And Bernie Sanders laughed in his face and said, open borders? That's a Koch brothers proposal. They want every, they want nothing more than
open borders. But he hasn't said a word.
Yes, he did a 180 when he was running against Trump. So that to me is a bellwether. The left used to be like Bernie Sanders. They used to be anti-immigration because they understood
anti-mass immigration
because they understood the fundamental and obvious truth that you can't have a wage floor if you have an unlimited supply of low-wage labor. That used to be the left's position. Today, if you have that position, the position they had 30 years ago, they call you a white supremacist and a racist. That's you see the shift in who they're talking to, who they care about.
So are you a Marxist who identifies more with the Democratic or Republican Party?
So when I look at the two parties, I ask myself, who is more likely to, I think neither party is speaking for the working class from an economic point of view. You know,
though you think Trump did.
I think Trump did. Yes. Right, I think okay. Trump really represented those interests, but he got a lot of flack from traditional Republicans for doing that. They didn't like that. They like this, you know, open borders. They like free trade. You know?
Well, and they wanted big companies to have cheap labor.
Absolutely. You know, like they say, you know, they know slave labor when they see it, right? Like they're not going to oppose that. So, you know, I think for a long time, there was a sort of handshake agreement between Democrats and Republicans that, you know, we need to focus on trade at the expense of the working class, but to bring in, you know, cheap products and cheap labor to benefit the elites. You know, Trump really threw a wrench in that. But today, if you look at where the Democrats are at and who they're speaking to, you know, you hear a lot of people saying, oh, the Democrats, their messaging is bad, right? And I always say their messaging is perfect. They're signaling exactly who they're speaking to when they talk about Green New Deal, which will replace thousands of good paying union energy jobs with low wage, terrible, you know, minimum wage, temporary green jobs, right? That's not a problem in messaging. That's a problem in who their base is, right?
It's a problem in the message.
Exactly. Exactly. So I look at the Democrats, they're catering in every item on their list. They're catering to a very overeducated, liberal, coastal, professional elite. That's who their base is now, who they see as their base. They've long abandoned the working class. So I look at the Republican Party and I think there is a real divide. You have people like Marco Rubio standing up and saying, you know, like he told me in an interview 6 months ago, there's a real divide between our donor base and our voter base. And we need to start speaking to the voter base. There's no one on the Democratic side saying that. So to me, I'm looking very, very with a lot of interest at this divide in the Republican Party where there is a real populist energy to have the kinds of economic reforms that the working class needs. But then, of course, there's the old Republican Party that's much more into that free market orientation. And I'm watching that struggle very closely.
Well, wait, you were interestingly juxtaposing free market and good for the lower class.
Yeah.
A lot of us would say free market is great for the lower class. It's government intervention that has killed the classes in this country.
So to me,
because you yourself said that too earlier about the handouts. You're not for handouts.
Yeah, no.
Okay. So that's.
So
that's not free enterprise.
Well, the way that I see it is we have what looks like a debate about economic policy in America, but is not a real debate. You have one side offering handouts, which the working class does not want. They believe in autonomy. They want to work. They want to support their families. They don't want to live on the dole, you know? So what the liberals are offering is just, you know, it's a salve on their guilt that they're so much richer than the people they claim to care about. But on the right, I don't know how you can look at these decimated communities in former manufacturing boomtowns, you know, and not feel like to me, NAFTA, offshoring of manufacturing, that was government intervention that traded trade for jobs. I think that elites see the economy in terms of trade and working class people see the economy in terms of jobs. And the government intervened to take millions, 5 million good blue collar middle class jobs and ship them to China. Now China has the fastest growing middle class. This enrages me. It enrages me. How could we have done that? How could, but that was done in the name of free trade. And I think that was a huge mistake. And I wanted to ask you about this. This is on my list of questions for you, actually. You know, I look at the working class. I look at the downward mobility. I look at these broken families. I look at the number of children being born out of wedlock from people who don't feel like they can afford to get married. You know, and I ask myself, okay, I think you and I would agree. There's clearly a spiritual component there. There's very clearly, you know, the decimation of religion, respect for religion, the decimation of the American family. Sometimes government subsidized, right? Sometimes government incentivized. I think we would agree that all of these things have contributed to the breakdown of the American community and the American family and these things that, you know, really are important for our nation's stability. But what I want to know is, like, I wonder if I could get you to agree with me that, okay, what the conservatives want is something I actually want too, which is for women to have the choice to stay home and raise their children. I think that's really important, you know? That gets back to that spiritual problem, that problem with the family. You know, that the fact that they can't afford to do that. But that's the question I wanted to ask you. Women can't afford to make that choice right now, because many men are not earning enough to give them that opportunity. Elizabeth Warren, 20 years ago, wrote an amazing book about this called The Two Income Trap. We've created an economy whereby, you know, she blames the feminists, you know, kind of in this implicit way. Whoever you blame, we've created an economy where working class Americans simply cannot afford
one income.
So, but that is an economic problem. To where I want to know, what are conservatives offering those men? We all want them to be able to support their families. The free market is not going to get them there. The free market gives Jeff Bezos all the money so that he can pay his drivers $15 an hour, which is just not a living wage. You can't raise a family on that, right? So what is the conservative free market response to that? Because from my point of view, I would love to see the Republicans take the forefront on it and say, you know what? We're going to be the party of American families. And what that means is we're the party of a living wage for one worker. You're raising a family. Jeff Bezos can't pay you $15 an hour. To me, that's a conservative point of view. So I'm so curious what you think about all that.
So I just to take the last one of the minimum wage, I went from supporting minimum wage to not supporting minimum wage. Because, and by the way, the opposite of the New York Times. The New York Times, I think it was in the 70s, said best minimum wage, $0, 0 cents. That was their editorial. Mm-hmm. So I've gone in the opposite direction. The New York Times is for it now, and I'm not. Only because everything I read about the minimum wage from people I respect argues against it. I mean, in a nutshell, the restaurant is now told you have to pay your waiters $15. And especially if it's a national minimum wage, that means it's true for Alabama, not just New York City, where they can easily pay $15 an hour, but not in Alabama. So what will happen is they'll raise the prices of their food. Nobody who owns a restaurant makes a lot of money. So they'll raise the price of food, and then fewer people will come. That's a vicious cycle. And of course, they raise the price of food, so the guy in the minimum wage has to pay more for food. So then what will often happen, as happened in Seattle, is just a lot of restaurants will close down. So to my mind, the guy earning a small wage is building up muscles, work muscles, to enable him or her, as the case may be, to then do more work and better work. You learn how to go to work, how to get up in the morning. These are just like building muscles. You don't start out with 100-pound weights. You start out with 5-pound weights or 2-pound weights. And so that's how I look at the minimum wage. You can't start at 100-pound weight. And these people who work hard, they work themselves up in life. But you're asking another question too, which is a fair one. How does the free market, which produces a Jeff Bezos, how does it help these vast numbers of especially men not making enough money to support a family, which you would like to see too, which I would like to see? So my question to you is Jeff Bezos' income relevant?
No.
Okay, so if he's not relevant, then the question is somewhat of a non sequitur. The fact that Jeff Bezos has, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars or whatever he has, or $100 billion, doesn't affect the guy. But there's no happy way to destroy the free market and keep freedom. Economic freedom is part of human freedom. So I have no choice. There's no perfect answer. But I will tell you the number of couples I know who simply have decided they will live on less money to be able to have a full-time mom in the house, and they will not eat out very often because they're usually religious, usually Christian. And although ultra-religious Jews will be in a very similar, although ironically, they do it the opposite. The woman works and the husband studies Torah, which is another issue for another time. But anyway, I can't see compromising on the free market and not losing liberty. So there's no happy answer to your question. The world was better when you could live on one income. That had its own disaster, because if the man divorced her, what could she do economically? Women who had devoted their lives to their family. This is the part of the modern origin of feminism, which I get. Look at what happened to all the women who did decide, I won't work outside of the house. Then there's a divorce, and she's left basically penniless because she has no profession to fall back on. So I understand all these arguments. Life is filled with trade-offs. And I'm just saying to you that I don't want to compromise on any aspect of freedom, including free speech. I am totally aware free speech allows for hate speech, just as I am totally aware that the free market allows for a Jeff Bezos. The tragedy of the Jeff Bezos, well, there are two. One you cited already from me, which drove me out of my mind, that during the lockdowns, Joe's hardware store had to shut down, but Walmart didn't. That was evil. That was pure evil. It was the Democrats' way of ruining small businesses, because they hate small business because they're usually conservative. They love Walmart. They love the big guy. So I am as furious as you are on that issue. But just as I understand free speech means that there will be hate speech, I understand that the free market means there will be a Jeff Bezos and a Walmart. I think there should be some antitrust legislation brought about. I do. That even free marketeers do believe in. And by the way, personally, I try to buy whatever I do from the internet from a store rather than Amazon. It's just my little way of trying to keep the littler guy in business. But if the tragedy is Jeff Bezos has made the decision to be on the left, as they all have, as Bill Gates has too, and that does hurt the country. But I know that there's a price paid for every freedom. That's my answer to you.
I guess what I would respond is, freedom requires certain basic needs to be fulfilled. I believe you had Yeonmi Park on.
Right.
In this very chair. And I remember she said, when you're starving, freedom doesn't mean anything because you're starving. Like the first thing you need is there are certain basic conditions. And to me, I just am not willing to pray next to somebody in shul who I am sentencing to never be able to live at the standard that I live at. Something in me really rebels at that, like to sit at home and receive a package from Amazon from someone who I know could never afford to buy property in my neighborhood. And I there's something in me that's...
I don't have that. It's funny. In that sense, you are
a Marxist. I'm a lefty.
Yes, there's no... I don't have that at all. I look at the guy who delivers my package, and I think this is beautiful. The guy is working hard. He probably has a wife. Hopefully he has kids. And if his head is screwed on right and his values are good and he has religion in his life, this guy doesn't have my material life, but he has a great life.
But you don't feel that as Americans, we owe each other something?
Of course I do. Uh-huh. That's a separate issue. I mean, look, my belief, the American ideal was I take care of me. I take care of my family. I take care of my community. Americans did that. De Tocqueville in the early 1800s wrote how uniquely charitable Americans were, how many associations we created, like the Rotary Club and the Church Club, to take care of the next guy. And by the way, to this day, conservatives give more charity and volunteer more time than liberals. Are you aware of that? Every study has shown that.
I'll even one up you. The middle class is thriving in red states, whereas blue states are these sort of feudal
like
dystopias.
California. That's right.
Filled with, you know, rich professional managerial class people.
That's right.
And the immigrants who service them.
That's
And that is extremely important. How did that happen?
You see, so let me react to you because I feel to your credit that I could be totally open with you. So I grew up like you, so I don't know if you're the first Jew in that seat, Marissa, obviously, but it's pretty, it's you know, for no specific reason, it's not most common to have a Jew in that seat. And so you live where I grew up, Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and we both grew up in religious Jewish homes. So I grew up in New York, as I said. So I grew up believing Democrats were good guys, Republicans were for the upper class. The little guy protector was the Democrat. Most Jews vote that way because they still believe that. Mm. But you no longer believe that.
Yes.
And you still vote that way. and which proves only, and I say this only with empathy, nothing else, how hard it is when it's drilled into you from your childhood and by your community that X is good and Y is bad. It is incredibly hard to get rid of that. So you will love this. I've never told this publicly, but you will appreciate this 100%. You watching will appreciate it 86%. So I grew up an Orthodox Jew, of course, never ate non-kosher food. And in my junior year in England, away from my parents, I decided to violate every ritual law in Judaism, not ethical law, ritual law. Because I wanted to observe, not out of habit, but out of conviction. And it was tough to do certain things when I had never done it. So it was very hard the first time I ate ham. But I want you to know, and this is revelatory, I think, to the non-Jews watching, but you will understand this. It was emotionally and Jewishly, that's key, harder for me the first time I voted Republican than the first time I ate ham.
Wow.
That's how deep it is in a Jew to be a Democrat.
An American Jew, yeah.
An American Jew, yeah. Not an Israeli Jew. They have nothing in common, by and large.
I would have no problem voting for a Republican if I felt that they supported the things that matter to me. And by the way, a lot of Republicans call me up and say, hey, what can I do to get the working class vote? You know, what should I be defending? What should I be supporting? And I'm only too happy to tell them what would make, you know, me or any of the, you know, working class people that I'm regularly in touch with vote for them. I mean, I there's a lot of people doing good work on the right that I would be happy to vote.
Right. Well, all right. But we'll get to the specific. By the way, I just want to say to the Jews watching, I don't eat ham now. I didn't eat ham after that year, but I only wanted to make the point about emotionally wrenching it was. And I first voted Republican. It was Ronald Reagan. I was already, you know, an adult when that happened. So, okay. So that gets me, now I'll push the challenge a little further. you're saying if there was a candidate who X, Y, and Z,
yeah.
Right. Okay. I don't vote for candidates. Mm-hmm. I only vote by party.
Uh-huh.
Because I vote by ideology. Uh-huh. I, the left is the threat to America that has never existed since the Civil War. That is my belief. It's too important to who you vote for that we have energy prices forcing the class you care about. Why is the class you care about paying $4, $5, and $6 for gas? Environmentalist movement, as I say, every time I talk about them, they are rich, white, bored, secular people like Al Gore. Mm-hmm. They are soulless, empty human beings trying to save the world to give their life meaning.
I totally agree with you about the environmentalism. In California, you have something that the environmental civil rights lawyer, Jennifer Hernandez, calls the Green Jim Crow. She has this amazing position paper about it, about how Black and Hispanic Californians are being pushed into the Central Valley, pushed into the hottest places where they're forced to pay because they can't afford, you know, to pay the, you know, rent, buy homes and, you know, where it's slightly cooler. They're pushed to the hottest parts of California. And then the energy prices are so high that they're paying 20-30% of their income just to have AC in their homes. And she calls it the Green Jim Crow. It's energy poverty is what she calls it. And
well, that's the word in Germany. It's called energy poverty. I don't remember the German word. That's right. By the way, it's Batya Unger Sargon who I'm talking to. She is one of the editors of Newsweek and a writer as well, and a thinker and a speaker. And I'm really having a great time. By the way, as one who is a very well-known Jew, I theoretically would feel anti-Semitism in the world that I live in, the right wing, the conservative world. And I have never, look, I see comments on articles of mine. Some people say, oh, you know, this Zionist, you're not going to listen to him, are you? But comments on the internet mean nothing. I mean, every sicko can write a comment, especially when you don't have a name, you have a pseudonym. But I got to tell you, in mainstream, this is what matters, mainstream, not the crackpots on either side. Mainstream left has a huge anti-Jewish component.
Yes.
Mainstream right doesn't.
Yes, agreed. We're very lucky to live in a country where let me put it this way. In England, when Jeremy Corbyn gives a speech to thousands of working class British people, and he starts talking about how Israel is a colonialist genocidal endeavor. I don't know if he's ever used those words, but you know what I'm talking
right.
about.
Right. Certainly apartheid state.
Yeah. Those people go crazy with excitement because their little spidey sense for, you know, 1,000 years, which has been primed to blame the Jews for, you know, class warfare and everything that's wrong with their lives. They hear Israel and he says Israel and they hear Jews and they get really excited because that's it's in the blood. It's in the soil in Europe. It's just there. It's a fact of European life. We are so blessed in this country that is just not the case. Our working class is deeply Zionist, deeply philo-Semitic. The Christian right is very philo-Semitic. We're just as you say all the time, there has never been a country that has been this good to the Jews. And I think it's so important to stress that because a lot of people are sort of talking about how America is becoming like Europe, where it's sort of chic on the left to hate Jews, to support boycotting Israel. That's true. It is becoming chic to hate Jews among a tiny little elite on the left, the progressive elite. You know what percentage of Americans call themselves progressives? It's 6%. And by the way, only—
But they run our elementary schools, high schools, colleges, newspapers.
100%. This is a point I wanted to make. Because I think for the first time in my life, Americans are getting more conservative because of left-wing overreach. I think the American people are going to save us. So I think for the last 50 years...
But they have to save us through the political process because you will continue to have next $7 gasoline if you don't allow drilling, if you don't allow fracking, if you don't allow nuclear power. I mean, that's the ultimate, I think, proof of the dishonesty of the environmentalist movement, that the carbon-free, they're against carbon-free nuclear power.
I think something Republicans don't understand that I would like them to is the vast chasm separating the Democratic leadership, the political class, the chattering class, the journalistic class, the intelligentsia, the universities, that 6% of progressives, from the rest of the Democratic voters.
Yeah, but they will still vote Democrat, so it's irrelevant.
But I think, okay, this is another thing I wanted to ask you about.
Good.
Okay, so you say we've never been, that we are more divided even than we were in the Civil War, because then we were only divided over slavery. Today, we're divided over everything.
I'm flattered that you know my opinions. That's right. I have. That's what I say.
I disagree. I have to disagree. I think that polarization is a totally elite phenomenon. The people who are trying to make us hate each other are people who make money off of it and people who get power from it. And I, you know, you don't, if you're running in a race against someone and you can convince the voters that the other guy is a groomer or that the other guy is a racist, it's game over, right? Because if it's me or Hitler, it's me, right? There's no real choice, right? So it's very clear why politicians are polarizing us, right? Because it gives them a lot of power, it makes things easier, and then they don't have to deliver for their constituents. But they're doing the same thing in the media and they're doing the same thing in big tech. Every time you see something on the internet that makes you feel rage, someone made $1 million. $1 million. Like, literally, they have hacked our emotions and turned our hearts into their little, you know, ATMs, where they're making money off of making us hate our fellow Americans.
So I have a response for you.
Let me just make one more quick point.
Yeah, sure.
I think all of the polling shows that Americans are just not that polarized. On even the biggest issues, you poll them, they're all somewhere in the middle. But the two parties are on either side of that. I have like a ton of examples, but let me hear you.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, the argument is not as true as it might be. I don't find it compelling for this reason. As I told you, I studied communism, so people are shocked to know that in the Soviet Union, I think the maximum percentage, I may be wrong, but the maximum percentage of Soviet citizens, I say Soviet, not Russian, because Soviet Union was Russia and all the republics around it, like Ukraine, under 10% of the population were members of the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. So to say, well, there's this big gulf between the Communist Party and the multitudes is irrelevant, because the 10% made all the policies. So if there was this big gap, why on God's earth is the average Democrat who doesn't agree that men give birth voting for them?
Well, okay, I'll just give you one example. Let's talk about abortion, okay? Abortion looks like one of these issues where we're totally polarized, right? 49% of Americans say they're pro-life, 49% say they're pro-choice. When you drill down into the numbers, over 60% of pro-choice people, so of Democrats, think it should only be legal for the first trimester. So basically the Mississippi bill, right? 15 weeks and you're done, you know? You need a really good note from your doctor for anything after that, because it starts to get a little barbaric, right? That's the median Democratic voter believes that. Meanwhile, on the right, 75% of Americans who think that abortion should be totally illegal, or who call themselves pro-life, let's say, 75% of pro-lifers believe there should be exceptions for rape, incest, and mother's health, right? If you did not choose to get pregnant.
I agree with you. All of that is accurate.
So what that means is you have, like, let's say 80% of Americans.
I don't think abortion will determine voting. Okay. So
let me make the point.
Okay.
The point is this. What happens? So 80% of Americans are sort of somewhere in the middle, agree on most of this stuff. You know, certainly illegal after 15 weeks, you know, after first trimester, certainly should be legal for rape, incest, and mother's health. And then, you know, it's like probably going to be 10% where they'll disagree. But so what do the parties do? You've got one party saying women have the right to choose until the day before the baby is due. That's feminism. And you hate women if you don't believe that, right? And the other side that's saying If you fall down a flight of stairs after 6 weeks and have a miscarriage, you're likely to face charges. So the parties are so extreme.
No, not if you're, no, that's an, no. You are only theoretically if you had an abortion, but the miscarriage is not an abortion.
No, that some of the bills have. If you, yes, if you do something, if you behave in a way that's considered reckless or whatever it is.
Oh, all right. Well, yes.
So, or total ban. Right. Oklahoma, total ban. No exceptions for the 75% of pro-lifers who think there should be exceptions for incest, rape, and mother's health.
Right.
So you're a normal American. You're in the middle somewhere, right?
Right.
And your choices
that's,
are.
So that's why I rudely interjected and said, I don't think that abortion will be determinative of most people's voting. I happen to agree with everything you just said. And by the way, I do think there should be exceptions made, even though it is not consistent with the belief that it is a human life. I fully acknowledge that. But I also believe that you always have to do what is better, not aim for the best.
Mm.
Okay? The best is the enemy of the better. So to get the vast majority of late term abortions gotten rid of, I'm perfectly okay with compromising. And I'll have to answer to God for that. But I think God knows I live on earth, not in heaven, and I have to deal with the realities of life. So the puzzle to me is not over abortion. The puzzle why you who say that there's this big gap between the left and the rest of the Democratic Party is why they vote Democrat for all these other issues. Do they want their kids sexualized at the age of five?
Well, I could ask you the same thing about Republican voters.
Ask me.
I mean, before you have, okay, let's take West Virginia, right? They you have Republicans who are blue collar people, you know, and they are voting for politicians who are Republican, but who are, enacting legislation on things like right to work laws, that if you speak to workers, you speak to electricians, you speak to carpenters, you speak to people in West Virginia, they will say to you, yeah, that hurts us. So why'd you vote for Republican? They have different reasons.
Yes, but they have a reason. I still don't know. I'm asking what the Democrats' reason is. The reason that a lot of Republicans would have is that every single union in the country is left wing. Unions hurt America.
No, I told that's I mean,
tell me,
we won't disagree about that.
I think right. OK, so I would love unions if they only cared about workers. Unions are the enemy of everything I cherish in this country, especially teachers' unions. The most corrupt, vile, anti-child, anti-American organization in the country. I mean, there are people tied with them, but that's the reason. The average West Virginian knows unions stink.
But you would support, like, collective bargaining.
I would support anything for the, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay, I have some questions
yes,
for you.
Yes, here
okay.
we go.
All right. Okay, I recently was on Michael Shermer's podcast.
Right.
And he asked me a very interesting question that I want to ask you.
Uh-huh.
He said to me, so you're religious? I said, yes, I'm religious. He said, okay, well, here's a question for you. Why are you Jewish and not Christian?
Oh, I get that every day. I get that. There hasn't been a time in my life. We were just talking right before we got on about how Christians often say, you know, I think you're the most prayed for man in America. And I think it's true because of the many wonderful Christians who pray that I receive Christ. And I don't take that, by the way, I just want to make it clear. I'm not only not offended, I'm actually touched by it. These people really do love me and I love them. Look, that's a whole fascinating discussion. I have that every year. I have Ask a Jew, Ask a Gentile with a prominent Christian thinker. And the issue, of course, comes up. I believe that Revelation as such ended with the Old Testament. And now, so of course, a Christian will say, yes, that's fine. And Jesus was foreshadowed in the Old Testament. So it's a matter of faith. My biggest issue is I don't believe that anybody could die for my sins. I have that issue. I have the issue of the divinity of Jesus. I don't have the issue with the messianic claims. By the way, I always explain to Christians, the Jews' problem was not that there were Jews who believed that Jesus was the Messiah. that never would have made the Jewish-Christian separation. The Jewish-Christian separation was over claims that he was God. And that went to the heart of Jewish theology. But of course, it's a triune God for the Christian, and I do believe Christians are monotheists, even with a triune God. But look, my view is that Christians true to their faith are doing God's work. That's what I believe. And as Maimonides, who was no fan of Christianity or Islam, because he was persecuted by both, the greatest Jewish thinker, many think, he said it's Christians who brought the world to the Torah more than Jews did. And I never forget that. That's a fact. The reason people know the word Genesis or Leviticus or Deuteronomy is because of Christians. In fact, I'm very sad about Jews getting as closed in their world as they did. God didn't choose the Jews to hide. God chose the Jews to spread his word. So, which is what I've devoted my life to, just as a side thought. But it's interesting that Michael Shermer, who's an atheist, would have asked you that question. So I will tell you a question I asked Michael Shermer, which I ask every atheist. And the answer to this question reveals to me whether I think the atheist is intellectually honest or not. Do you hope you're right or wrong?
Oh, it's such a good question.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I asked it, and it's probably on YouTube. And when push came to shove, to his credit, he said, of course I'd want to see my family after I die. Of course I hope I'm wrong. Okay. And it's the atheist who hopes he's right who is a fool. Not all atheists are fools, and not all religious people are wise, but the atheist who hopes he's right is a fool. You really want this world to be empty, devoid of meaning? You really want it to be a sheer material coincidence? You really want death to be the very end? Everything, every human, everything you've treasured, that is the end? You want that? Are you out of your mind, or have you not thought seriously about the consequences of atheism, which is true for half of them? They don't think the consequences.
What is something you hope you're wrong about?
Well, I wish I were wrong about human nature. I wish I were wrong about a lot of things. I wish I were wrong. I'll be specific. I wish human nature was better than it is. But I know human nature.
What would change your mind about that? What would convince
nothing.
You?
Nothing. It's not changeable because I have thousands of years of cruelty in human history, and I raised children who, thank God, are good. But as I say all the time, if kids were basically good, why would you have to say thank you 10,000 times? Literally 10,000 times. I think the average parent has said, say thank you 10,000 times. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't gratitude be natural if we were basically good? So I wish that people valued, I wish I were wrong and people valued freedom more than free things. People value free things more than freedom. I wish I were wrong.
Okay, but you once gave Christopher Hitchens a hard time, I think very cleverly. You said to him, do you ever doubt your atheism? Because
right.
I doubt as a religious person.
Right.
And that was the fact that he said no was to you proof, I think this was really smart, was proof that he is a believer and that you are the real thinker.
That's correct.
So, but here it seems like there's no room for doubt anymore in your mind. There's nothing you could possibly learn that would make you reconsider this position.
Which position?
That people are fundamentally bad.
Yeah, but that's not a position. It's almost like saying, what would change your position on rain being wet? I mean, there are certain facts of life. The evidence is overwhelming that human nature is not basically good. So somebody would have to present to me evidence that I had never considered. That's, yes, I guess that could happen. But so this is not a leap of faith. That God gave Moses the Ten Commandments is a leap of faith. I firmly believe it, but I know it's a leap of faith. That human nature is not basically good is not a leap of faith. Mm-hmm. It's completely the result of reason and evidence. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about Revelation. I'm really interested to know. So religion is really important to you. So you say you believe and you've taken the leap of faith that the Old Testament was, there was a revelation. It was right. God-given.
Right.
Are you Orthodox? And if not, mm-hmm. why not? Like, wouldn't the natural conclusion from that be go as far as one can go? What makes you put the line as how far you're willing to go in terms of religiosity? What makes you put the line there? What's the rationale there?
So in a nutshell, this I'd have to explain to the non-Jewish viewer, which is the great majority, of course. So there are two huge aspects to Judaism, biblical and rabbinic. Rabbinic is obviously from the word rabbi, the great rabbis who formed the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Talmud, the second holiest work in Judaism after the Bible. So I believe that all the laws of the of Judaism, all the biblical laws are in the Torah, the first five books. I believe the five books are from God. That is that, and I make that case in my Bible commentary, the Rational Bible.
Why do you think that? Just in a
nutshell. My arguments for the divinity of the Torah, I think I give 20 arguments.
Oh, wow.
In my Rational Bible. I'll give you one that you won't expect, but I find, for me at any rate, is extremely telling. If people wrote the Torah, they would never have depicted the Jews as negatively as the Torah depicts them.
Totally. What a self-own. I love that.
I had a feeling you'd love it.
I love that.
Yes. Nobody makes up a crappy history about themselves. It's it's unbelievably
genius.
Telling to me. So, I mean, the brilliance of the five books, the leap, the first God in history that judges all of humanity by the same moral standard. The first God in history that separates the world not by tribe or nationality or even faith, but by moral behavior. The first God in history that is not male or female. This God in no way was involved in sexual activity. The first in history. I mean, there are so many firsts that I can't believe people came up with it. So it's all there. I hope you read it. It's my pride and joy. But Costco ordered 25,000 copies of Deuteronomy. I consider that one of the greatest achievements of my life, coming out later in the year. But anyway, so again, to your question. So then come the rabbis, and they add a great, great number of laws. So whereas I feel I have to obey God's law, with regard to the rabbis' laws, I feel now, of course, the Orthodox Jews say, well, they're not the rabbi's laws. They're the oral law that God gave Moses. But I don't see that's a leap of faith that I'm not quite willing to make because there's no evidence in the Torah that God gave a separate body of law in addition to that. I know all the arguments. I went to yeshiva for till I was 19 and then taught Judaism my whole life. Listen, my only allies in Jewish life are generally Orthodox Jews. I have a great affection for them. And I am making the case for Judaism, and I brought more Jews to Judaism than probably any living Jew right now. I do believe. By the way, I think I brought more people to Christianity than any living Christian right now, which is really, and I'm proud of both, to be honest. Because I make very compelling rational arguments. People don't realize how much they love reason. When they hear reason, it blows their minds, but they're so not used to it. There's so much non-rationality. I mean, if most college graduates believe men give birth, do you realize how powerful the non-rational has become, the anti-rational? So when That's why they scare me. They scare me much more than the true believing Christian or Jew. The true believing secularist is a scarier creature because they apply irrationality to real life. The religious person applies non-rationality, as I do in my own religiosity, to religion, which is fine. I believe God brought 10 plagues on Egypt. Is that fully rational? Of course not. But what difference does it make to the world today? But if you think men give birth, if you really think kids can choose their gender at the age of 5, you're damaging this world. I'm not doing any damage to the world by believing God brought frogs on Egypt. They're damaging the world. The true believing a leftist, the true believing secularist is much scarier than the true believing religionist.
So coming off of that, you argue a lot that, as you just said, that morality comes from the Torah, from the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Right.
That without the Bible, we would not have a sense of, you know, that atheists have nothing to hang their hat on, you know.
Well, they have both reason and conviction and emotion, but it's all still personal opinion.
Right.
If God didn't say don't murder, murder being wrong is a matter of opinion.
Okay.
There are no moral facts outside of God.
Okay. So my question is this. So in the Torah, when God is planning to destroy Sodom, Abraham is very upset about this.
Right.
And he turns to Hashem and he screams at him.
Hashem is God.
He says, Chalila lecha me'asos kadavar hazeh.
Right.
How dare you do this? And he says, "Hashoifet kol haaretz lo ya'aseh mishpat." Will the judge of the whole world not do justice?
Right.
He says, "How dare you suggest you're going to kill the righteous with the evil?
Right.
That is unjust.
Right.
Right. And God listens to him. But so, I read that and I think there was no Torah then. This was before the Torah was given, right? This was Abraham and God were, you know, in their little love bubble, right? It was the two of them. And, but Abraham is calling upon a standard, an objective standard that is both external to him and external to God and demanding that God adhere to that standard, meaning that the standard and what God was planning to do are different. And he forces God to change the plan to fit a standard. And that standard is justice.
Well, God didn't change the plan.
He gave him a chance to, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So, but the point being is that moral, that to me is proof of natural law.
Yes. I have no issue with that. But it doesn't mean that it is objectively real if there's no God. I believe God put conscience in human beings. This is how I look in a nutshell at what happened. God wants us to be good. So he starts out by giving us a conscience. It's blown very quickly. Cain kills Abel. God realizes the human being is a really flawed creature. Next, then God gives a series of universal laws. The Jews often say there's 7 laws. It doesn't matter. Not to murder, not to eat the blood of a living animal, meaning you can't rip off a limb of an animal. Not to steal, not to commit adultery. There's some basic universal. That doesn't work. So God has God's third way of making the world decent was to give a whole body of law to one people, have them try to live by it, spread it, and be a model of it. And that was called the chosen people. That was his third attempt. By the way, for Christians, there's a fourth attempt. That didn't work either for the Christian. And by the way, there's a lot of merit to that argument. And so now God comes down in human form and suffers with us. And there's a lot I respect in Christianity, obviously. And it had a tremendous appeal. By the way, Muslims then say that didn't work. The world was still lousy. So there's a fifth try, Muhammad. And Mormons say there's a sixth try, Joseph Smith. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating every religion is ultimately acknowledging, well, it hasn't worked that well till now, but this one will work. So good. I want there to be moral Olympics. We produce better people than you. I wish we had such a thing in this world. So I have no doubt that there is a built-in conscience. You don't need the Ten Commandments to know murder is wrong, but you need to believe that, and by the way, natural law is dependent upon God. Natural law is, and nature's God. That's in the Declaration of Independence. Not just nature, nature's God. Without God, there's no such thing as natural law. I know secularists can argue all they want, that's a leap of faith. Then they'll say, but God is a leap of faith too. Fine, but at least let's all acknowledge if there is a God, it does make morality absolute. There are moral facts. If there is no God, there are moral opinions.
So what you're saying is that there is natural law because God created it. And
yes,
someone who does not believe in God cannot then say, but I still believe in natural law.
Oh, sure they can. Uh-huh. They just can't say
it's absolute.
That's right. Uh-huh. That or there
objective.
Are moral facts.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yes, that's correct.
Uh-huh. Very interesting.
Also, I don't think it works in the final analysis. My poor, but not terrible, but middling analogy is if there were signs on the road, speed limit, whatever you naturally think is proper. That's how I would look at no God with natural law.
I love that.
Oh, good. So maybe it wasn't middling. Maybe it really was a good analogy.
Okay, last question.
You know, this is a great, we should really bring in thinkers like her to ask me questions, because look, this is a special time with you, I gotta say.
Okay, yeah. You said, I forget when you said this, I think it was recently, that it would be, your word was paradisical, if the liberal states would secede. Now, I understand
that's
that
right.
You think that the left is the greatest threat to America, and we can debate that for sure. But my question is this. Like, actually, this is a question I have for a lot of Christians as well. Like, as a Jew, like, I think that, you know, debate, there's no knowledge without debate.
They don't debate. If they debated, I wouldn't say
that's
it would be paradisical.
That's what my husband said you were going to say. He said they
give
don't
him my
debate.
Best regards. Tell him I have a cigar for him. But that's, that would be awesome. I have offered $10,000, which means nothing to these people, I'm sure. But if they want more, I'll raise it. For any New York Times left-wing columnist, which is 99% of them, to debate me publicly, anywhere in the country, I'll fly where they want to go. I'll do it in their living room. They will never debate us. They don't debate us. We want them on our programs. They don't want us on their programs. I would have any major leftist come on my show.
But I'm saying when you say it would be paradise to get rid of them, don't you want leftists in your paradise just to keep you honest? Like just to make
No, I
sure?
want liberals in my paradise. Leftists are purely destructive.
Uh-huh.
There is no good side to leftism.
Uh-huh.
It suppresses freedom everywhere it gets power. There is no exception to that.
Uh-huh.
It suppresses free speech. It's a bad thing, leftism. Mm-hmm. Liberalism is a beautiful thing, but liberals are weak and they vote left.
Mm-hmm.
Which some Jews, for example, who are used to voting Democrat.
No, it's, I mean,
you're not
I know
weak.
You're making fun of me, but.
I'm ribbing you,
but,
I'm not making fun
but
of
I
you.
But I will say, I too am very dismayed at the kind of the woke capture of much of the Jewish community.
That's another issue. But the only thing, it's very simple. The Jews who believe the Torah is from God are conservative. The Jews who don't are overwhelmingly leftist. It's as simple as that. When Jews leave a divine scripture, they become fools. sometimes very sweet fools, but fools. It's all about. It's divine scripture. That is the dividing line. If in Christianity too, the Christians who came to believe that men wrote the whole Bible, they drifted off into leftism. Those Methodists, those Congregationalists, those Presbyterians, those Episcopalians. The exact same thing happened in both religions.
It's so interesting.
You need a divine scripture to stay real.
There's a woman who wrote a book. I forget her name now. She's basically trying to bring a reform movement to evangelical Christianity. She's sort of opposed to the idea that there's a hierarchy, that the husband is the head of the household, that women can't be in positions of leadership. And she's actually very effectively sort of, you know, marshaling support for a kind of reform revolution. And I was interviewing her for a podcast we had at Newsweek. And I said to her, I feel like I'm like the ghost of Christmas future coming to you and saying, listen, bad things. I totally understand where you're coming from. I grew up in a very patriarchal society and a very orthodox society where women were, you know, always subordinate to men at some level. I didn't have the same education as men. I, you know, wasn't taken seriously. And for a woman who, like me, who's sort of a thinker, and, you know, that was very difficult. I hated sitting behind the partition. I felt like that was dehumanizing, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I feel like, you know, having experienced, first of all, liberal streams of Judaism, but also if I could tell you one thing about what we learned from the reform movement, and it's this: I don't want this to be true. But the truth of the matter is I can tell you with 95% certainty if your grandchildren are going to be Jewish based on whether or not there's a separation between men and women in your synagogue. You know, there's something about these reforms that I don't know why it is, but the threat to the traditional thing that seems like it's so tangential, like whether you have a separation between men and women, why should that matter? But you get rid of that and a lot of things start to crumble along the way. And I think that's something, you know, that I really learned, you know, growing up is, you know, there's a reverence that conservative men have for the woman as the hearth. The right. Woman as the home.
Yes.
For that position.
Indeed, the woman as woman.
The woman as woman. Yes.
More than this reformer does. She doesn't really think there's a difference between men and women. But if you think there's no difference between men and women, you don't revere either of them. The whole point is that their difference is what makes them reverable.
But I feel conflicted about it because
Your conflict is totally legitimate.
I would not have, if yes. I had stayed completely in the
right.
way.
That's right.
I wouldn't.
There
is
no perfect answer. There just isn't. Just as I said about the people who aren't going to make enough money, even though you think it'd be ideal if the mom stayed full time to take care of the home, which is the ideal in my opinion, except in the case of the women who work at PragerU. I really had to throw that in. I'm so sorry. Because they could bring their babies here and I'll take care of the baby because we need them. And I'm thinking of one in particular who is due in a month or 2 months. But anyway, having gotten that off my chest. There are no perfect answers. I remember debating this issue in Jewish life when they were talking about ordaining women as rabbis. I was not a supporter, even though I have no problem attending a synagogue if the rabbi is a woman and she's wonderful. None of their arguments except the equality one. And everybody knows a woman's brain is as good as a man's brain, often better. So that's not the issue. The rabbi figure is not just the brain. Their argument that it will attract young women to synagogue, I knew was nonsense. I knew it in advance. It's like I saw the future. Reform Judaism is in rapid decline. Conservative Judaism is virtually disappearing. And they both ordained women, and they attracted no women to the synagogue. They attracted no men to the synagogue because boys need, he's been really good. He's been here a long time. You say goodbye to Batya now. Okay. He's meandering out the door. He's really a riot. That was classic liberal dreaming.
Yeah.
Oh, girls really need a rabbinic model. That's not true. Boys and girls need a male rabbinic model. There are different roles in this world for men and women. And by the way, if the Orthodox start ordaining women, the same thing will happen. It will drift into the secular culture, which I think modern Orthodoxy is already beginning. I'm debating a rabbi very soon, an Orthodox rabbi, a modern Orthodox, who says people are basically good. That is the antithesis of the Torah, the literal antithesis. secular people at Princeton believe that, but he's modern Orthodox, and he has accepted a very, very modern secular belief from the age of the Enlightenment. So there are no perfect answers. That is why I am at peace with my Orthodox Jewish friends. One of my sons is Orthodox, and he says, "Dad, I love your Judaism." He grew up with it. Mm-hmm. Which is extremely serious Judaism, but not fully Orthodox in practice. But he said, there's no such community. And I said, David, you are entirely right. If you want a community, and you should, you have to be Orthodox. That's correct. I fully acknowledge that fact. If I could live another 100 years, I could create a community of Jews who live the way I do. I do believe, but I'm not going to live another 100 years. So it is the way it is. But I accept the contradictions of life. And by the way, to me the lesson of Abraham arguing with God, to get back to your great story, is another reason I so love the Torah. You can argue with God. Yeah. Do you know that? It's interesting. Christians really know their Bible, but even many Christians don't remember what Israel means. Struggle with God, fight with God. That the Torah not only allows, but encourages me to argue with God is another reason. I love the Torah so much that this will sound truly heretical to many people listening. I love the Torah more than I love God. And the Torah is my vehicle to loving God and believing in God. And I don't believe in the Torah because I believe in God. I believe in God because I believe in the Torah. That is why my commentary has touched a lot of lives. Mm-hmm. I am so intellectually and emotionally committed to those five books. That I have acknowledged I don't find it easy to love God. There's too much pain in this world built in, and it's just hard for me to do that. I revere God, I obey God, I respect God, but I wrote an essay. I don't know if you ever saw my essay, and I don't ever say this to guests, but I'm so touched at how much you know of what I've said or written, but you would love this. I wrote an essay that the most difficult law in the Bible is to love God with all your heart. And you know what I conclude? It makes God lovable that he knows he's not lovable.
That's so good. Wow.
Yeah. It's well, you're good. So how do people read you, find you, see you? I want to promote you. What should they do?
Well, last time you had me on your show, my book sales went through the roof. So you seem to have magic in that department.
Well, I'm glad. I always love hearing that. I always tell authors, look at where you are on Amazon today, and now look tomorrow. So what is the book?
My book is called Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. And it's about how the media got woke, and I argue in the book that was actually about class. It looks like a story about race or about politics or about Trump, but it's not. It's about class, you know, journalists used to be working class. And over the course of the 20th century, they became part of the elites. And as they sort of left, you know, working class neighborhoods and life and started to live next to corporate lawyers and accountants and doctors, they abandoned the working class of all races, with the most devastating impact on the Black community. And it's just a history of American journalism, how it got so bad. So
what is the name again?
It's called Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy.
Bad News.
And you told me that I should do an audiobook version, and the audiobook is out today. So it's available on audiobook now.
Oh, good. Yes. Did you read it?
I did, yes.
Oh, I'm delighted. And what do you do at Newsweek?
I'm the deputy opinion editor.
Meaning
that every day I solicit two or three op-eds from people across the political spectrum, across the racial spectrum, across the religious spectrum, trying to get the most interesting take on the big stories of the day in the news to really represent American life.
So you don't write in Newsweek?
I write for other publications. I write for the Daily Mail sometimes, for the New York Post. I write for Spiked, which is a great British publication.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
That's nice. What does your husband do?
He's a dentist.
You get free dental care?
No, he won't see me. He says I'm a bad patient.
God, I asked the right question. That is hilarious. Why are you a bad patient in his
teacher.
View?
Well, because when you, the thing that keeps you in the dentist chair while they're doing such unpleasant things to you
right,
is you're a little bit afraid of them. And when it's your husband, you're not a little bit afraid of him. So,
so if
halfway
he should be
through,
able,
you just are like, enough of this.
Oh, I see. So he should be able to intimidate you. That's part of the dentist's role.
I think so. You know, listen, my book is dedicated to him because as I wrote in the dedication, you know, Rei Ahuvi Ezer Kenegdi, you know, Eve is described in the Bible as an Ezer Kenegdo, a helpmeet against him. It's a very interesting.
I know I do. I
grammar.
Deal with that a lot in my commentary.
And that what the commentators say is that, you know, you need an adversary in your marriage.
But she's still the helpmate.
Exactly.
So yes. No, that's exactly
right.
I lucked
out.
I use that quote for my dedication to my wife of my five volumes. That's the quote I use. And keneged not only means against, but it also means equal to.
Yes.
So it's actually a helpmate who is his equal, which sounds self-contradictory, but it isn't. That's the beauty of the wifely role in a good marriage, his equal and his helpmate. Well, you are a joy.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really, really an honor to talk to you.
Well, it's mutual. What can I say? I hope we do it again.
Me too.
All right, everybody. If you didn't enjoy this, you'll never enjoy a fireside chat. It was really a great time. I'll see you next week. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.